out!" Pharaoh shouted. "Just go!"
And so, that very night, Moses and God's people fled out of Egypt and out of slavery. They were free at last. God's people would always remember this great rescue and call it Passover. But an even greater rescue was coming. Many years later, God was going to do it again. He was going to come down once more to rescue his people. But this time, God was going to set them free forever and ever. God makes a way. Moses and God's people escaped out of Egypt and into the wilderness. They didn't know the way, but God knew the way, and he would show them. "I will bring you to a new home, a special land," God promised them. "I will look after you. I am with you." God sent a big cloud for them to follow, a pillar of smoke stretching up into the sky. It moved in front of them as they walked and shaded them from the blazing heat of the day. And when it was time to rest, it stopped. All through the cold desert nights, it kept them warm, glowing like a fire. God led his people through the desert to the edge of a great sea. They were just wondering how to cross it when suddenly they heard a terrible thundering and pounding. It sounded almost like horses' hooves. They shaded their eyes to look back and screamed. It was! Pharaoh and his army were coming to get them. Pharaoh had changed his mind again. "Get my slaves back!" he screeched and charged out into the desert after them with 600 of his fastest horsemen and every single chariot in Egypt. What were God's people going to do? In front of them there was a big sea. It was so big, there was no way round it. But there was no way through it. It was too deep. And they didn't have any boats, so they couldn't sail across, and they couldn't swim across because it was too far, and they would drown. And they couldn't turn back because Pharaoh was chasing them. They could see the flashing swords now, glinting in the baking sun, and the dust clouds, and chariot after scary chariot surging towards them. So they did the only thing that there was left to do. Panic! "We're going to die!" they shrieked. "Don't be afraid!" Moses said. "But there's nothing we can do!" they screamed. "God knows you can't do anything," Moses said. "God will do it for you. Trust him and watch!" "But there's no way out!" they cried. "God will make a way!" Moses said. Another minute and it would have been over, but then the strangest thing happened. God made the pillar of smoke move. It moved behind his people and hid them from the Egyptians. Then God sent a strong east wind to blow all night long. It blew on the water of the big sea. It blew it to the left and it blew it to the right until it blew it into two towering walls of water. And there, right through the middle of the sea, a muddy pathway opened up. And God's people walked across on dry land. When the Egyptians tried to follow, the walls of water crashed back down on them and swallowed them up. God's people were safe. They danced and laughed and sang and thanked God. When there had been no way out, God had made a way. Many years later, once again, God was going to make a way where there was no way. From the beginning, God's children had been running from him and hiding. God knew his children could never be happy without him, but they couldn't get back to him by themselves. They were lost. They didn't know the way back. But God knew the way. And one day, he would show them.
10 ways to be perfect. So there they all were. Grannies, granddads, babies, uncles, aunts, children's, mums and dads, out there in the middle of the desert. They had blisters from all the walking. They were hungry and thirsty and much, much too hot. "We don't like it," they said. "It stinks."
And so did they, for that matter, because no one had taken a bath in weeks.
Now, remember, because this is something they'd forgotten, God had done amazing things for his people. He'd hidden them inside a cloud, he'd moved the sea, he'd set them free. But God's people still weren't happy. They didn't care about being free. Wasn't it better when they were slaves? At least they had had lots of nice food to eat.
"God doesn't want us to be happy," they said.
It was the same lie that Adam and Eve had heard all those years before.
"God has brought us out here to kill us. God doesn't love us."
But they didn't know God very well, did they? Every day of their journey, God kept on showing his people how well he would look after them, if they would trust him and obey him. When they were hungry, God made the sky rain with food. Bread coming down from heaven. "What is it?" they asked each other. They didn't know, so they called it, "What is it?" Which, of course, is a very good name for something when you don't know what it is. When they were thirsty and started quarrelling, God made water flow from a rock. Moses called that place Quarrelling, because that seemed like a good name too. And still God's children didn't trust him or do what he said. They thought they could do a better job of looking after themselves and making themselves happy. But God knew there was no such thing as happiness without him. So God led them to a tall mountain. God wanted to talk to his people and show them what he was like. He wanted to help them know him better and tell them about the special land he was going to give them. "The whole earth belongs to me," God said. "But I have chosen you. You are my special family. I want you to live in a way that shows everyone else what I'm like, so they can know me too." God called Moses up the mountain. The great mountain shook. A thick cloud fell. Thunder roared, lightning crackled, and God gave Moses 10 rules called commandments. "I want you to love me more than anything else in all the world, and know that I love you too," God told them. "That's the most important thing of all." God gave them other rules like, "Don't make yourselves pretend gods. Don't kill people, or steal, or lie." The rules showed God's people how to live and how to be close to him and how to be happy. They showed how life worked best. "God promises to always look after you," Moses said. "Will you love him and keep these rules?"
"We can do it. Yes, we promise."
But they were wrong. They couldn't do it, no matter how hard they tried. They could never keep God's rules all the time. God knew they couldn't. And he wanted them to know it too. Only one person could keep all the rules. And many years later, God would send him to stand in their place and be perfect for them. Because the rules couldn't save them. Only God could save them. The Warrior Leader. After Moses died, God gave his people a new leader. His name was Joshua, which means the Lord saves. Joshua
was going to lead God's people into the special land God had promised to give them. By this time, God's people had been wandering around in that baking desert for 40 years. So you can imagine how sick they were of sand and anything yellow and tense and walking and being hot, and how happy they were to reach the edge of the desert and to see their beautiful new home right there in front of them, all cool and green and lovely. There was only one problem. Jericho. Jericho was a city, but it wasn't just any old city. It was a fortress, and it stopped anyone from getting into the land. The people looked at Jericho, at the big, giant, scary walls around it, at the tall, towering ramparts, at the heavy iron gates bolted shut, at each other. What would they do? No one knew. But God knew, and God told Joshua what to do. But Joshua must have looked surprised, because it was a very odd battle plan indeed, as we'll soon find out. Then God made his people a promise. I will always be with you, and I will never, ever leave you. If you do what I say, your lives in the new land will be happy, and everything will go well. So Joshua gathered his army together. They had their swords and spears and shields. They were ready to fight. But the plan wasn't about fighting. It was about trusting and doing what God said. Joshua's army went marching, marching, marching around the city, day after day after day. They're too scared to fight, the people in Jericho said. Oh, but they were wrong. God's people weren't scared. They were waiting, waiting for God to tell them what to do next. On the seventh day, God told his people to march around the city, not once, but seven times. Then God told everyone to make as much noise as they could. Has anyone ever told you to make as much noise as you possibly can? Well, imagine that noise. Add 39,999 other people making that noise too. And you get the idea. Ear-splitting. And, as it turned out, stone-splitting too, because the huge, strong walls of Jericho just crumbled to the ground, as if they were made of sand. Jericho vanished in a great cloud of dust. So it was that God's people entered their new home. And they didn't have to fight to get in. They only had to walk. Joshua said, God has brought you safely here. Now will you do what he says? Everyone said, we promise. Only God can make your heart happy, Joshua said. So don't pray to pretend gods. No, they said. Never. Well, I'm afraid they didn't keep their promise. They didn't do what God said. And many years later, just as God had warned them, things would go badly for God's people. They would lose their home. Enemies would capture them and take them off as slaves. And God's people would scatter into many different lands. But God's plan was still working. One day, he would give his people another leader and another home. But this home, no one could ever take from them. The teeny-weeny true king. God's people had a new land. Now they wanted a king. But God is your king, Samuel told them. He is the one who looks after you best. But we want a real king, they said, one we can see. God knew that a king might not be kind to his people or look after them as well as he would. But God's people didn't care. They wanted a king, and they wanted him now. So God gave them a king. He was called Saul, and he seemed like a good king at first, but he became proud and stopped listening to God. He didn't obey God or love God with his whole heart. "Saul can't help me with my plan," God said. "I need a king who loves me and will teach my people to love me. I need a true king." God had just the one in mind. "Go to Bethlehem," God told Samuel. "You'll find the new king there." Samuel's job was to listen to God and tell people what God said. So Samuel went to the little town of Bethlehem. God told Samuel to go to Jesse's house. God was going to choose one of Jesse's sons to be the new king. Jesse had 7 strong sons. Now, in those days, if you were going to be the king, you didn't have to be the richest or the cleverest, although that was always nice. You had to look like a king, which meant you had to be the tallest and the strongest, so you could carry the longest swords and biggest armor and defeat everyone. And it didn't hurt to be handsome either. Samuel asked Jesse to bring him each son in turn. So Jesse brought the oldest, tallest, strongest son. "Oh, well, this must be the new king," Samuel thought. "He looks like a king." But God didn't choose him. "You're thinking about what he looks like on the outside," God told Samuel. "But I'm looking at his heart, what he's like on the inside." So Jesse showed Samuel his next oldest, tallest, strongest son. But God didn't choose him either. In fact, God didn't choose any of the 7 sons. Samuel said, "Is that all?" Jesse laughed. "Oh, well, there's the youngest one, but he's just the weakling of the family. He's only teeny." "Bring him," said Samuel. Jesse's youngest son came running up, and God spoke quietly to Samuel. "This is the one." His name was David. "He has a heart like mine," God said. "It is full of love. He will help me with my secret rescue plan. And one of his children's children's children will be the king. And that king will rule the world forever." Samuel anointed David's head with oil, which was a special way to show that you are God's chosen king. "You will be the new king one day," Samuel told him. And sure enough, when he grew up, David became king. God chose David to be king because God was getting his people ready for an even greater king who was coming. Once again, God would say, "Go to Bethlehem. You'll find the new king there." And there, one starry night in Bethlehem, in the town of David, 3 wise men would find him. The young hero and the horrible giant. God's people had some scary enemies, but the Philistines were the scariest of them all. And now the Philistines had come to fight them. The Philistines had a secret weapon called Goliath. Goliath was a terrifying soldier and, worst of all, a giant. A giant so strong and so tall and so scary that no one had ever been able to fight him and live to tell the tale. So, there they were. The Philistines standing on the top of one hill, God's people standing on top of the other. Every day, Goliath came out and shouted,
Send your best soldier to fight me. If he wins, we will be your slaves. But if I win, you will be our slaves.
No one spoke. No one moved.
Chickens! Goliath bellowed. Your god can't save you. I'll rip your heads off and have you on toast.
His beady, greedy eyes glowered at them hungrily from under his horrible helmet, as if any minute he really might just gobble them all up. And he laughed his terrible laugh. Ha 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 ha! It boomed, echoing horribly around and around the dry, dry valley. Well, Goliath might just as well have been a green, slimy monster with three heads, because God's people froze with fear. Their eyes glazed over and they turned deathly pale. They knew if someone didn't do something quick, if someone didn't save them... Nah, but God would do something. He would send someone to save them. Now, you remember that David was the youngest son of Jesse? Well, his brothers were soldiers in the army. One day, when David brought his brothers their lunches, he saw Goliath, and he saw how scared everyone was. "Don't be afraid," David said. "I'll fight him for you." "Oh, you're only a little shepherd boy," the king said, "and Goliath is a great soldier. How will you fight him?"
God will help me," David said.
So the king gave David his royal armor to wear, but it was too heavy and too big, and David couldn't even walk.
"I won't need this," David said.
Instead, David picked out five smooth stones from the stream. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Took his slingshot and walked towards Goliath. Step, step, step. Goliath walked towards David.
Thud, thud, thud. "You?"
Goliath peered down at the small boy.
"I am little," David shouted up to him, "but God is great."
Goliath laughed an even terribler laugh than usual.
"Ha!
It went. With just one swing of his giant sword, Goliath could finish the boy off. But David kept going.
"It isn't how strong you are or how many swords and spears you have that will save you. It is God who saves you. This is God's battle, and God always wins his battle."
David put a stone in his sling, swung it around, and let it go. The little stone flew whizz like a bullet through the air and struck Goliath thud right between the eyes. Goliath stopped laughing. He stumbled and staggered and crash! Fell dead. When the Philistines saw Goliath was dead, they ran away. And when God's people saw them running away, they cheered. God had saved his people. David was a hero. Many years later, God would send his people another young hero to fight for them and to save them. But this hero would fight the greatest battle the world has ever known. The Good Shepherd. David was a shepherd, but when God looked at him, he saw a king. Sure enough, when David grew up, that's just what he became. And David was a great king. He had a heart like God's heart, full of love. Now, that didn't mean he was perfect, because, well, he did some terrible things. He even murdered a man. Oh no, David made a big mess of his life, But God can take even the biggest mess and make it work in his plan.
"I need a new heart, Lord," David prayed, "because mine is full of sin. Make me clean inside." God heard David's prayer. He forgave David, and he made David a promise. "I will make you great, David. And one day, a king will be born into your family, and he will heal the whole world."
Did you know that David was a songwriter too? In fact, his songs were so good, they might have been in the top 40 charts if they'd been invented then. David's songs are like prayers. They're called psalms, and this one is called the Song of the Shepherd. It's probably number one on the psalm charts. And it goes like this. "God is my shepherd, and I am his little lamb. He feeds me, he guides me, he looks after me. I have everything I need. Inside, my heart is very quiet, as quiet as lying still in soft green grass in a meadow by a little stream. Even when I walk through the dark, scary, lonely places, I won't be afraid, because my shepherd knows where I am. He is here with me. He keeps me safe. He rescues me. He makes me strong and brave. He's getting wonderful things ready for me, especially for me, everything I ever dreamed of. He fills my heart so full of happiness, I can't hold it all inside. Wherever I go, I know God's never stopping, never giving up, unbreaking, always and forever love will go too." God gave David that song to sing to his people, so they could know that he loved them and would always look after them, like a shepherd loves his sheep. And one day, God was going to do something that would inspire thousands upon thousands of new songs. God was going to show his people once and for all just how much he loved them. Another shepherd was coming, a greater shepherd. He would be called the Good Shepherd. And this shepherd was going to lead all of God's lambs back to the place where they had always belonged, close to God's heart. A little servant girl and the proud general. Naaman was a very important man in a very important army of a very important country. So you see, he was very, very, very important. But Naaman was sick. He had leprosy, which is a nasty thing that stops you from feeling anything. Bits of you fall off without you noticing, like bashed fingers and squished toes. It might sound funny, but it wasn't. And Naaman certainly wasn't laughing. There was no cure. It never went away. And in the end, it killed you. Naaman needed help. Now, there was a little slave girl who worked for Naaman, and she knew someone who could help him. But there was a problem. Naaman was her enemy. Not long before, Naaman had led an army raid on her home in Israel. He had killed her whole family, carried her off to Syria, and made her into his slave. Every night she cried herself to sleep. She had lost everything. Why would she, of all people, want to help Naaman? Didn't she hate him and want to hurt him back? Didn't she want to make him pay for the wrong he'd done? That's what you would expect. But instead of hating him, she loved him. Instead of hurting him back, she forgave him. "I want Naaman to get well," she said to her mistress. "There's a man in Israel called Elisha who can heal him." "I'll go," said Naaman, loading up his wagons and putting on his flashing armour. "But I'll go to the palace, because that's where someone important like me gets healed." So he hurried off to Israel and went straight to the king. "My healing, please," he announced. "Well, I can do lots of things," the king replied, "but only God can heal." Just then, a message from Elisha arrived. "Send Naaman here," it read. So Naaman hurried off to Elisha's house. But Elisha didn't even come out and greet him. He just sent a servant instead. "Doesn't Elisha realize who I am?" Naaman thought. But what the servant said next made him even crosser. "Wash in there," he said.
"Just wash?" Naaman laughed. "In that slimy, stinky river?"
He looked around to see if this was some kind of joke. It wasn't. "Any person can wash in a river," he thought. "I am Naaman. I am important. I should do something important so God will heal me." And he rode off in a rage. Of course, you and I both know that's not how God does things. All Naaman needed was nothing. It was the one thing Naaman didn't have. God knew that Naaman was even sicker on the inside than he was on the outside. That Naaman was proud. He thought he didn't need God. His heart didn't work properly. It couldn't feel anything. You see, Naaman had leprosy of his heart. God was not only going to heal Naaman's skin, he was going to heal his pride. Naaman finally agreed to wash in the river. And instantly his skin became smooth like a baby. Naaman wanted to pay Elisha. "God healed you. You can't pay," Elisha said. "It's free." And so it was that a very sick man was healed, all because of a little servant girl who forgave him. God knew sin was like leprosy. It stopped his children's hearts from working properly, and in the end it would kill them. Years later, God was going to send another servant to forgive as she did, to forgive all of God's children and heal the terrible sickness in their hearts. Their hearts were broken, but God can mend broken hearts. Operation No More Tears. Do you know what your name means? Well, there was once a man called Isaiah, and his name meant God to the Rescue. Now, that might sound like a bit of a funny name to you, but it was just the right name for Isaiah because God had a special job for Isaiah. You see, Isaiah's job was to listen to God and then tell people what he heard. Now, God let Isaiah know a secret. God was going to mend his broken world. He showed Isaiah his secret rescue plan, Operation No More Tears. This is the message God gave Isaiah. It was like a letter God wrote to his children. "Dear little flock, you're all wandering away from me, like sheep in an open field. You have always been running away from me. And now you're lost. You can't find your way back. But I can't stop loving you. I will come to find you. So I'm sending you a shepherd to look after you and love you, to carry you home to me. You've been stumbling around like people in a dark room. But into the darkness, a bright light will shine. It will chase away all the shadows like sunshine. A little baby will be born, a royal son. His mummy will be a young girl who doesn't have a husband. His name will be Emmanuel, which means God has come to live with us. He is one of King David's children's children's children, the Prince of Peace. Yes, someone is going to come and rescue you, but he won't be who anyone expects. He will be a king, but he won't live in a palace, and he won't have lots of money. He will be poor, and he will be a servant. But this king will heal the whole world. He will be a hero,
He will fight for his people and rescue them from their enemies. But he won't have big armies, and he won't fight with swords. He will make the blind see. He will make the lame leap like deer. He will make everything the way it was always meant to be. But people will hate him, and they won't listen to him. He will be like a lamb. He will suffer and die. It's the secret rescue plan we made from before the beginning of the world. It's the only way to get you back. But he won't stay dead. I will make him alive again. And one day when he comes back to rule forever, the mountains and trees will dance and sing for joy. The earth will shout out loud. His fame will fill the whole earth as the waters cover the sea. Everything sad will come untrue. Even death is going to die. And he will wipe away every tear from every eye. Yes, the rescuer will come. Look for him. Watch for him. Wait for him. He will come. I promise. Love, God.
Poor Isaiah. He read God's letter over and over to God's people, but no one listened to him at all, ever. They didn't want to hear God's promise. They didn't believe it. Did it sound maybe too good to be true? A story that ends happily ever after? Well, it does sound like a fairy tale, doesn't it? And as anyone will quickly tell you, fairy tales aren't true. Or are they?
Daniel and the scary sleepover. Things were not looking good for God's people. They had been captured and taken far from home, and now they were slaves of the king of Babylon. But God had not left his people. He was with them, and he was looking after them. Daniel loved God and obeyed him. Now, God made Daniel able to understand lots of difficult things, so it wasn't long before the king of Babylon noticed him. King Darius liked how clever Daniel was, so he made Daniel his most important helper of all and put him in charge of lots of other helpers. But the other helpers didn't like this. They wanted the king to like them best. They wanted to get rid of Daniel, so they spied on Daniel. They tried to find things wrong with Daniel, things they could tell the king, things they could... there weren't any. None. They couldn't find anything at all. Except, there was just the one thing. Every day, three times a day, without fail, no matter what, Daniel went to his room, closed the door, and prayed. They smiled to themselves. Let's get the king to make a law. No one is allowed to pray to anyone except to the king. Daniel won't obey this law and he'll be punished. They were pleased with themselves for being so clever and hurried off to tell the king. The king liked their idea. He didn't know they were tricking him, so he made it into a law.
Everyone must pray, only to me. If you don't, the lions will have you for their dinner.
Daniel heard this. He knew it was wrong to pray to anyone except God. He had to do what God said, whatever it cost him, even if it meant he would die. So Daniel went to his room, closed the door, and prayed. Well, that's just what the bad men knew Daniel would do. They skipped straight off to tell the king. Oh, your most glittering highness, your law says, does it not, that everyone must pray to you alone, sire?
Yes, said the king.
Oh, magisterial brightness, then correct us if we're wrong. But it would seem that Daniel is praying to God.
Not to you.
The king was sad. He had been tricked. But he didn't want to hurt Daniel, but he couldn't change his law.
and so he let the soldiers throw Daniel to the lions. "May your God, who you love so much, rescue you," the king said. The king went back to his palace, but he didn't sleep that night. Not a wink. He tossed and turned until finally, at the first glimmer of dawn, he leapt out of bed and ran straight to the den. "Daniel," he cried, "has your God rescued you?"
"Yes,"
Daniel shouted.
"God sent an angel to close the lions' mouths."
And there, resting his head on Daniel's lap, was the biggest lion, purring like a little kitten. The king brought Daniel out of the den.
"Look," he said, "Daniel doesn't even have a scratch."
The king made a new law.
"Daniel's God is the true God, the God who rescues. Pray to him instead."
God would keep on rescuing his people, and the time was coming when God would send another brave hero, like Daniel, who would love God and do what God said, whatever it cost him, even if it meant he would die. And together, they would pull off the greatest rescue the world has ever known.
God's Messenger. God had a job for Jonah. But Jonah didn't want it.
"Go to Nineveh," God said, "and tell your worst enemies that I love them."
"No," said Jonah. "Those are bad people doing bad things."
"Exactly," said God. "They have run far away from me. But I can't stop loving them. I will give them a new start. I will forgive them."
"No," said Jonah. "They don't deserve it."
"I'll run away," Jonah said to himself. "Far away. So far away that God won't be able to find me. Then I won't have to do what God says." "It's a good plan," he said, because as far as he knew, it was a good plan. But of course, it wasn't a good plan at all. It was a silly plan. Because you can run away from God, but he will always come and find you. Jonah went ahead with his not very good plan.
"One ticket to not Nineveh, please,"
he said, and boarded a boat sailing in the very opposite direction of Nineveh. Well, it wasn't long before a fierce wind blew and the boat started to lurch and pitch and roll and everyone started turning green. Jonah sat bolt upright in his bed. You see, the first thing that went wrong with Jonah's not very good plan was that God sent a big storm after him. The sailors couldn't sail their ship properly.
"We're sinking!"
they screamed and started throwing everything overboard, suitcases, food, whatever they could find. And by now Jonah knew that the storm was his fault.
"Throw me in instead," he shouted to the sailors, "and the storm will stop."
The sailors weren't sure.
"It's the only way you can be saved,"
Jonah cried. And so,
"One, two, three, splash!"
No sooner had Jonah hit the water than the waves grew calm. The wind died down. And the storm stopped. Just then, when Jonah thought it was all over, when he was sure he was going to drown, God sent a big fish to rescue him. The fish swallowed Jonah whole with one big gulp. Jonah must have thought he'd died. It was so dark in there, like a tomb. But then he smelled the rotting food and felt the slimy seaweed and knew he wasn't dead. He was in the belly of the fish. Sitting there in the darkness for 3 whole days, Jonah had plenty of time to think. Pretty soon he realized his plan was, well, a very silly plan indeed. He was sorry for running away. He prayed to God from inside the great fish and asked God to forgive him. After 3 days, the fish spat Jonah safely out onto a sandy beach. Just then, Jonah heard someone calling his name. "Go to Nineveh?"
God said. And this time Jonah said,
Yes.
He went straight to Nineveh and told everyone God's wonderful message. Even though you've run far from God, he can't stop loving you, Jonah told them. Run to him so he can forgive you. The people of Nineveh listened to Jonah, and they started loving God. They learned to do what God said and to stop running away from him, just like Jonah. Many years later, God was going to send another messenger with the same wonderful message. Like Jonah, he would spend 3 days in utter darkness. But this messenger would be God's own son. He would be called the Word, because he himself would be God's message. God's message translated into our own language. Everything God wanted to say to the whole world in a person. Get ready. Have you ever been to a party that lasted a whole week? How about a sermon that went on all day? Well, that's what happened to God's people after they came home from being slaves. They had forgotten how God wanted them to live or who they were supposed to be. So Ezra and Nehemiah read them the rules God had given Moses. But something odd happened. The more the sermon went on, the sadder they all got. Why? Was the sermon that boring? No, not really. It was strange, you see. As Ezra read the Book of Rules, it worked like a mirror. It showed them what they were like, and they didn't like what they saw. They saw that they had not been living the way they should. They saw that they were cruel and selfish.
We've blown it, they cried. Now God will punish us.
They thought they knew what God was going to do, but they didn't. Of course, they might have picked up a clue from Ezra's name, which means help is here, and an even stronger one from Nehemiah's name, because his name means God wipes away our tears. And that, as you'll see, is just exactly what God was getting ready to do. Ezra looked at God's children. Great hot tears were welling up in their eyes and streaming down their cheeks. He stopped his sermon mid-sentence and shut the book.
We're having a party, he shouted. And so that's just what they did all week long. God wants us to be happy, Ezra said. All day they listened to stories about the wonderful things God had done for his people. How he made the world, how he gave a special promise to Abraham, how he rescued them from slavery, how he spoke to Moses and showed them how to live, how he brought them to a special land. How he rescued them, no matter what, time after time, over and over again. Because of his never stopping, never giving up, unbreaking, always and forever love. They remembered how God had always, all through the years, been loving his children, keeping his promise to Abraham, taking care of them, forgiving them, even when they disobeyed, even when they ran away from him, even when they thought they didn't need him. Then God told his children something more. I can't stop loving you. You are my heart's treasure. But I lost you. Now I am coming back for you. I am like the sun that gently shines on you, chasing away darkness and fear and death. You'll be so happy. You'll be like little calves running free in an open field. I am going to send my messenger, the promised one, the one you've been waiting for, the rescuer. He is coming, so get ready. It had taken centuries for God's people to be ready,
But now the time had almost come for the best part of God's plan. God himself was going to come, not to punish his people, but to rescue them. God was getting ready to wipe away every tear from every eye. And the true party was just about to begin.
He's here. Everything was ready. The moment God had been waiting for was here at last. God was coming to help his people, just as he promised in the